Support comes from the St. Louis Chamber Chorus. Season 68 concludes at John Burroughs at 3 p.m. on May 26th with the United Nations commissioned Voices of Today by composer Benjamin Britten, featuring youth and adult singers. Tickets at chamberchorus.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. In the 1960s,
if you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
St. Louis nearly became one of the most magical places on Earth.
Salagadoola, metrigaboola, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. Put them together and what have you got? Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
It was in the form of a planned Disneyland called the Riverfront Square, and it captured imaginations as local leaders negotiated with Walt Disney himself until the deal went bibbidi-bobbidi-bust. Writer Devin Thomas O'Shea recently revisited the subject. Writing for the History News Network newsletter, his essay, Walt Disney Presents Manifest Destiny, tells the story of what might have been, as well as the disputed reasons it fell apart. And no, it was not over beer. Here to discuss Disney and St. Louis and why the two just couldn't get along, we welcome to the show Devin Thomas O'Shea. Devin, great to have you back on the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me again.
So take us back to the early 1960s. Disney at this point was already massive with film hits like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, as well as Peter Pan, and it opened Disneyland in California. Now, you write that Disney was drawn to St. Louis for sentimental reasons. Why is that?
Yeah, this was at the point where Anaheim was up and running, the first Disneyland, but the Florida one had not yet been, the deal hadn't been struck. He was attracted to St. Louis because Disney grew up in Marceline, Missouri, which is a small coal mining town with the railroad running through it. And he also had his first animation studio in Kansas City, the Laugh-O-Reel studio. So he was attracted. All of these elements in Missouri end up making their way into the classic Disney canon.
Mm-hmm. And how is it that it got started? Was it Disney who first approached St. Louis, or did St. Louis make some overtures to him?
Yeah, this was at the height of urban renewal in downtown St. Louis. This is when the city leaders decided to completely wipe the slate clean in downtown for the Arch and the baseball stadium, removing St. Louis's Chinatown, as well as important, historical markers everywhere. But the idea was that the city fathers wanted to have some sort of historical attraction, and they invited Disney to make a movie or a film that would be shown there. And as lots of Disney biographers note, you know, he sometimes heard, here's one thing, and then, it extrapolates out into a whole complex and then a building and then a whole another Disneyland that was going to be right next to Busch Stadium, sort of in the shadow of the Arch.
Mm-hmm. So the seed came from St. Louis and then grew into something else.
Exactly.
Yeah. We want to invite you to this conversation. Do you have memories from that time in the 1960s? If St. Louis had become the home of a Disneyland park, what would you want to see in it? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. If you're on X, send a note to @STLOnAir. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpr.org. So Devin, what was it about St. Louis that was attractive to Walt Disney as a city? What was it about STL?
Yeah, I think counterintuitively, the thing that really drew his attention was the interstate system. So the urban renewal really worked in that Walt saw these gigantic highways that barreled through, for example, Mill Creek Valley and displaced tens of thousands of people, African-American St. Louisans, or the Hill. In exchange for that, we got sort of Walt Disney's attention of, oh, maybe downtown could be this gigantic funnel for people to visit a St. Louis-themed, Disney park.
Mm-hmm. And were the same things sort of in the minds of the St. Louis folks who wanted Disney to come?
Yeah, I think so. This idea that, like, I had just written about Jack Conroy for The Nation, and he, in one of his novels, talks about the old St. Louis before the arch gets put in. And there's, it's the downtown riverfront area is dilapidated, but there's also a big bohemian artist scene. There's lots of black businesses down there. But the city fathers wanted to turn it much more into an attraction for tourism, of mm-hmm. like a reason to visit St. Louis.
Right. Yeah. And you write that Riverfront Square, that was the name of what they were imagining, themed around old St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And Disney told reporters at the time that the exhibits would be built around the history of St. Louis and its role as the gateway to the West. Devin, what did that mean for a hypothetical Disneyland?
Yeah, that definitely meant that Disney was very interested in, like, the frontier mythos of, like, Davy Crockett, for example, or Daniel Boone. And this meant that, like, this is sort of Disney standing in the 1950s, creating a nostalgic version of St. Louis as he understood it through Mark Twain and steamboats and the river as this sort of great open adventure and the frontier as this invitation for white European settlers to come through the gateway to the West, to settle it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So your piece does go into sort of what the park experience was supposed to be like.
Yeah.
Take us on a bit of a tour.
Mm-hmm.
How would people be making their Disneyland memories?
Yeah, this is interesting because I think it's hard to picture from the blueprints sometimes. So you would be, as opposed to like Disneyland that is basically like a city that is Disney themed, this was really only going to be one big gigantic building with a bunch of layers in it. And so you would sort of approach this big Disneyland park that was indoor, crucially, because, the weather in Anaheim is only a little bit better than that in St. Louis.
Right, just minimally,
slightly.
Yeah.
But that was a big problem for the project, and that it had to all be indoors because, you can't make money when, it's raining and cold and all of that in the winter. So you would approach this giant structure, and on the outside there would be sort of a Merrimack Caverns thing on your left maybe, and there would be a big fountain with the doors beyond that, and on the right would sort of be this big steamboat or there were other plans where there would be like a boat ride right there.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd go in and then there would be these big zigzagging floor stairs, like ramps.
Yeah.
Sort of like a river. And so you'd be sort of going up and down the river, up and down the stairs. There's a big subterranean level too.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of stuff in there.
What was going through your mind when you learned about all of this? I was born and raised in Canada. Mm. I had family in the Los Angeles area, so I visited Disneyland when I was a kid. So as you're describing, what could have been here, it's sort of mind-blowing to imagine that even some fraction of that would be here in St. Louis. So again, what were you thinking as you were reading about all of this?
Oh, it was very strange. I think what was most striking was just that the idea of Disneyland was so malleable at this time. There was only the Anaheim Park, and so then there was this proposed structure for St. Louis that would be like a miniature Disneyland. And I almost got the feeling of like, oh, well, you could have this in Pittsburgh also. This could be in Washington, D.C. You could have a Disneyland that was like much more flexible and exportable. But instead, we got these sort of megalithic Disneylands, Florida one.
So the piece that you wrote, it is really emphasized that this plan was not just talk. And you've made reference to the blueprints. There were drawings, these plans. The first set of blueprints sold in 2015 for $27,000. I mean, what exactly was in the blueprints?
Yeah, there was, these were drawn up by one of the Imagineers. This is Marvin Davis. And the sketches sort of lay out that zigzagging staircase model and sort of each floors of that building, each of the floors. There were like these 360-degree like video areas, cineramas or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was like sort of there was like a big section for like animatronics. There was also a lot of like the Cinderella ride being right next to the Lewis and Clark ride being right next to Pinocchio. And then like the Mike Fink ride, my favorite one of the piece.
Okay, we're going to get back to Mike Fink.
Yeah.
As far as how St. Louisans were reacting to this plan, I mean, what was it that newspapers were saying at the time about public sort of response to this?
Yeah, I think my friend Cody is really into wrestling, and she talks about kayfabe a lot, which is sort of like play acting that the wrestlers do. I think there's a big amount of kayfabe between August Bush and Walt Disney, these
okay.
sort of gargantuan Americana figures who are duking it out over like, do you want St. Louisans to have fun or not? And
oh, boy. Okay.
So Walt took the position, or at least in the newspapers, the big dispute was said to be that Walt didn't want to serve liquor at all in Disneyland. He was a little snooty about, like, you know, I don't want this to become, I forgot what he called it. It's like an old-timey bar district or something like that.
Uh-huh.
He wanted this to be a presentable, family-oriented thing, and sort of framed August Bush, who wanted really badly to sell beer in this institution, as like, oh, this drunkard wants to, like, you know, serve Budweiser's at a family-oriented park.
Right.
How dare he?
And again, this was the way that it was set up. This was the narrative that people were reading in papers.
Right. And people would write letters to the editor saying, like, oh, please don't let this all fall apart because of beer. And like, but that would, as you're suggesting, not the real reason why much of this fell apart. The real reason comes down to like, which is cheaper, downtown St. Louis real estate in 1950 or Florida swampland real estate?
We're going to take a very quick break here, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation with writer Devin O'Shea about St. Louis, Disney, and a canceled theme park. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. We're talking today with writer Devin O'Shea. His latest essay looks back at a plan that would have made St. Louis the home of Disneyland in the 1960s. We also want to hear from you. Would you have been in favor of a Disney theme park in St. Louis? If so, what St. Louis story do you think it could or should have told? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpr.org. Now, earlier we got an email, and this says, my grandfather, Ray Tucker, mayor of St. Louis from 1953 to 1965, decorated his office with political cartoons.
Oh, wow.
This one from Tom Engelhart, cartoonist related to the Riverfront Development. So thought Elaine might be interested, yes. And this is a 1963 cartoon from the Post-Dispatch. And it shows Mickey Mouse looking over the St. Louis skyline with a single word caption, consultant. So, you know, is this what it was like, you know, Disney sort of surveying all of St. Louis as a consultant, as it were?
Yeah, I think that was irresistible to some of the illustrators of the time, of just having sort of... Mickey is really towering over sort of the stadium and the arch and that. And there's a student paper called The Outlaw at WashU at the time that also drew sort of Disney haranguing the arch, holding onto it with one hand for one of their editions. I think that was definitely a fear, is that Disney's a big guy and he's coming to downtown. And I think that even... Gussie Bush felt a little bit of the pinch of like, oh, this guy's going to come in and sort of, he's going to have more than a toehold in St. Louis. And mm-hmm. if the Disneyland happens, he's definitely going to be at the table suddenly.
Right. Now, before the break, you know, we had talked about all the plans that went into this park. Walt Disney himself came to St. Louis to present this plan, and his Imagineers had made those blueprints we talked about. Obviously, it never became reality. Why is that the case?
Yeah, that is the case because Disney in this period is also always has one eye on like the Disneyland that's going to happen in Florida in the Epcot Center. There's a bunch of scholars who've talked about this as like the St. Louis plan was never going to be the next successor to the Anaheim plan. It was going to be like sort of a middle ground. Downtown St. Louis real estate, as cheap as it is at that moment due to white flight and redlining and the way that the city and the county are mapped out, that caused downtown to empty even faster when the riverboat economy evaporated. But even then, the real estate could only get so low, and mm-hmm. you cannot compete with free swampland in Florida that also has giant interstates mm-hmm. connecting it.
And when you say free, how?
The Florida real estate? Oh, I mean, I think that's another thing that came up is like, if Disneyland would have ended up here, would St. Louis have become more like Anaheim and Orlando? Would it look more like sort of a government that is attached to this giant Mickey Mouse machine? I don't know, probably.
Yeah. So there were disputed reasons and rumors for its failure. We've talked about the way that the media sort of framed what was going on, that beer was blamed.
Right.
Money also was an issue.
Big, yeah. It would have required a lot of taxpayer money for mm-hmm. sure.
So, I mean, how much was the Bush family really to blame for this breakup? I mean, you mentioned that August Bush was kind of like, I don't know whether I want Walt encroaching on territory.
Right. Especially if it's going to interfere with maybe Grant's Farm or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the amount of tax money was astronomical that St. Louis was going to have to cough up in addition to building the Arch and Busch Stadium. And I would say that it's money that is the ultimate factor here rather than – but in that kayfabe, I think it's also interesting that Walt kind of got the easy way out. You know, he got to look like a very dignified, moral man, you know, clean Disney mm-hmm. As he walked away from a deal with the beer baron.
Right.
Know?
So, I mean, this part of the story rings familiar insofar as what has happened and happening in modern day St. Louis, you know, a massively rich developer
yeah.
plus one big project to revitalize downtown and riverfront. And all it needs is for the public to pay for most of it.
Right.
Is that a connection you were hoping that folks would make, you know, as they read your piece? I mean, is there much of a difference between Disney in the 1960s and a sports team owner like he who should not be named?
Stan.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I was necessarily explicitly making that connection, but I do love a tyrannical business guy narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And Kroenke definitely fits the – I also love a con man story. I know Disney is not necessarily considered a con man, but he did have to do a lot of fleecing details and maneuvering and being careful about his public relations image. Same with August Bush. Stan Kroenke, I've written about Rex Singfeld before. I'm working on a book about the Veiled Prophet and all of those guys. So I'm definitely attracted to just the way that one guy can kind of embody symbolically all of like St. Louis's or a city's ambitions and almost use sort of the willingness to make St. Louis a great place against us who actually live here and pay the taxes and all
yeah.
that.
So do you think that to some extent we're seeing history repeat itself? I mean,
I think that's happening always with downtown, right? There's always this downtown is a fascinating unconscious object in the greater St. Louis imagination, including the county and the periphery after that, of just like downtown is dangerous. Downtown is also historically important. Mm-hmm. And the media, news, and people who talk about St. Louis endlessly sort of all feed into this narrative about downtown, whether it's, you know, weak and needs us to acquiesce to whatever, you know, big business wants, because if something moves away, it'll sort of dry up and float off. Mm-hmm. But from a historical perspective, you know, St. Louis is important because we got it right on the river. We got it right in between two big confluence areas, and the riverfront is not only enhanced by its historical record, but also there's an enormous amount of infrastructure in St. Louis, including transportation. Like, the downtown area will always be valuable. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of, like, exactly how that's going to look and what narrative St. Louisans want it to, which direction St. Louisans want to push it in.
Right. Well, and speaking of narratives and stories, mm-hmm. you talked about a Fink earlier.
Yeah.
So tell me, what is it that compelled you to write this piece, and what does Fink have to do with it?
Well, yeah, like I said, I'm always interested in a rich guy narrative, but also the intersection of like myth and the American frontier came through. Nobody had written about the Mike Fink ride that was going to be part of Riverfront Square. And Mike Fink is like one of the frontier tall tale mythical figures. He is the king of the keelboaters. He sort of starts off as like this hero of the river who is a tough guy, and he wears a feather in his cap that's like a taunt to any of the other tough guys who want to fight him. And so he's this big, braggadocious, but also singing and very musical man of the river, who then over time in the lead up to the Civil War especially becomes more of an avatar for like frontier justice, extrajudicial, racialized violence. He has only so many tales. One of them is being a sharpshooter and being able to shoot the scalp lock off of a Native American's head. That's like the little hair piece. Or being able to shoot the heel out of a fleeing slave. The river has always been an escape route for freedom in the lead up during American slavery. And so Mike Fink was, in a way, like the cop of the river, but not official. He was the more of a prototype of the Klansman, or a prototype of an extension of the plantation owner.
So in the last 30 seconds, I just want you to address the title of your piece, which is Walt Disney Presents Manifest Destiny.
Sure.
And is that what Disney was presenting here?
I think so. I love when they Disney-fied sort of story of American history. It tries to get represented into like a Disneyland ride. And I think that, yeah, the whole piece is just about like the way that that breaks down.
Devin Thomas O'Shea is a writer and journalist based here in St. Louis. He's the author of the essay Walt Disney Presents Manifest Destiny for the History News Network newsletter. Thanks so much for joining us, Devin.
Thank you for having me.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
in Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights. At Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.